Tim, when I reached out to you, I was excited to talk to you about everything, shoulders and life, and I was just grateful that you would take the time to, jump on the podcast with me.
I was grateful that you asked. This is an honor to be on the Carl Pioli podcast.
It's amazing. It's second time around. First time around, you were with Jacko, and that's when you were heavily focused on the School of Calisthenics. And since you've made somewhat of a change and pivot into focusing specifically on shoulders, although I know that you are an all-around performance person, why shoulders?
A great question. There's a number of different things around this. So the first bit, why shoulders is interesting, is because I've had my own shoulder problems over the years. So for people who haven't seen anything that we've done over the years of any kind, my background is strength and conditioning. Before strength and conditioning, I was a very average rugby player, but very enthusiastic, but dislocated my shoulder more times than I know and ended up having two reconstructive surgeries. At that time, and how I found my way into calisthenics was I'd done the rehab the second time round, physio guided, and they're like, "Yeah, you're good. You can go back and play rugby." I was like, "Yeah, I'm not ready for that. Like, I'm not. I can do these low intensity band exercises, and I can lie my back with a stability ball and balance that thing all day long. But I can't tackle a guy who weighs 120 kilos. I'm like 75 kilos. I'm not a big person." So calisthenics started with me trying to explore the handstand as a way to make sure my shoulder was going to be stable, because I thought if I can do a handstand, then that's going to give me some confidence. My shoulder was that bad that the first time I remember going out to try and practice a handstand with no gymnastics background, I didn't know if I was going to dislocate my shoulder or not. It was in a pretty bad place, but I knew that I needed to do something. So we went on a real deep dive around that side of things, around calisthenics and bodyweight training. At the time, we were starting to get feedback from coaches going, "You know what? When I do this stuff, my shoulders feel really good. And when I stop, they don't." And that had been mine and Jacko's experience as well. I was also working in strength and conditioning with a lot of swimmers. So we're doing a lot around the shoulder and understanding load around the shoulder. So I started going into the literature and going, "Right, what are we actually doing? What are we dealing with?" So we look at what physio principles are, and we're doing a lot of those, but now at a greater scale. And then I'm sat there like reflecting back on all this stuff again. We've got this thing which is super powerful for people with the shoulders, with shoulder problems. And there's lots of people having issues in various different sports. And you go to conferences and you talk to people, you listen to podcasts, and everyone's like squat, deadlift, hinge movements. Like, everyone talks about the lower body. You pick up a research journal and all of the articles predominantly will be about the lower body. And there was nobody in strength and conditioning having what I thought was a proper conversation about the shoulder. And when you go through education phases, nobody was really educating well around the shoulder, largely because I think it's complex and people didn't understand it that well. So it was difficult. And because I like solving complex problems, which is why I did so much in Paralympic sport, I just sucked my teeth into it. I was like, "I'm going to have a crack at this because I've got personal experience, I've got professional experience, and I think I've got this really powerful philosophy around how we train the shoulder, which sits perfectly in between late-stage rehabilitation and can take people all the way through to high-end performance if that's where they need to go." Mm-hmm. So that's why shoulders.
That's a good reason. One of the big mistakes that I've made and many make in the fitness and strength and conditioning world is compare the hip to the shoulder and just say, okay, let's just oversimplify and say the shoulder is similar to the hip. And this is it. that's pretty much what you get. And then when prescribing exercises beyond pressing and pulling, whether it's bench pressing or overhead pressing or pull-ups, there's not much more that goes into it other than some rotational exercises. But I'm curious. I want to tackle this conversation around shoulders by first addressing what are the main issues that you see across the board, whether it's in high level sport and people who are in the last chapter of their lives and struggling with some shoulder issues.
Yeah, I love that point because I use the example or the comparison of the hip and shoulder all the time in presentations, because people say like, "Oh, it's a ball and socket joint, so they're the same," and that's not the same. So to contextualize this, because this will then help me to lead into what the problems are that people are having. If you take the hip, we've got the head of the femur sits into a really deep acetabulum, and it covers pretty much the whole of the joint surface that's in contact with the pelvis. Around that, we've got lots of stable or stabilizing ligamentous tissue. We've got lots of muscle around it, and we've got a joint which is designed to be, yes, mobile, but is structurally very stable. You're not going to meet that many people that have dislocated a hip, but you'll meet a lot of people that have dislocated shoulders. When you look at the shoulder, we've got a humeral head, which is three times bigger than the socket that it sits on the scapula. The scapula needs to move in order for us to be able to get the hand into various different positions. And remember, the job of the shoulder is to position the hand in space. So all the stuff that you want to be able to do with your hand and all the range of motion and all the forces needs to be administered or controlled or orchestrated by quite a complex system of the scapula, the humerus, and then we've also got our ribcage and clavicle, collarbone, involved in that as well. So we've actually got four joints. So when you say it's the same as the hip, it's not the same as the hip, it's much more different. We have a massive amount of mobility and therefore a minimal amount of stability. So the big problem that, and where I kind of came with this challenge around understanding and coaching people to have better performance with their shoulders came from, is a sense of so many people go in the gym and they go and get strong. We will go CrossFit, right? I'm just going to go and smash weights. Output all the time, high incapacity. So we've got strength is good. The joint is inherently mobile. So we've got mobility, which is generally most people pretty good, or we can often see issues with some types of people as well. But then you've got this stability piece. And now the joint is so reliant on dynamic stability because we don't have much ligamentous structural support. Everything is controlled by muscle forces. So that needs to be controlled, coordinated, rhythmical to make sure the shoulder can move and articulate well. Now, because the brain is task output focused and is bothered about where the hand is in space and whatever you want to do with that hand at the time, it will find you a way to do whatever it is that you want. It just doesn't always use option A. So if the shoulder moves well, we get really nice quality shoulder movement and we have no problems. Well, you are now 50 snatches into a workout and you've got 100 wall balls coming up and the brain is like, we can't do this anymore. So it will find you option B followed by C and D. And then we start to just kind of use these different movement options that the shoulder has to execute an output. But at the same time, we're just often banging up tissues and causing problems and complications around it. So common things that we'll see is anterior shoulder pain, just feel all kind of like gnarly around the front of the shoulder. Subacromial pain, or as often called like impingement in the shoulder, but they argue about what terminology they use these days. Mobility can be an issue. And because there are so many components around the shoulder, we need to think about how we unpick what the root cause is. And the final point on this is if we are in a total body sport, for example, we're using multiple joints simultaneously, whether that be sport, CrossFit, whatever, just basically not lying on a bench and pushing a bar in the air, the shoulder has to be part of the bigger movement system. So if we aren't thinking also about how the lower body creates and generates forces and transfers those through the pelvis and the core so that the shoulder can then express force, we might be having to fix ankle and hip problems to stop the shoulder from having to pick up the slack, but we don't have efficiency through the kinetic chain. So there's a big whole kind of conversation going, how do we kind of look at this and where do we start with the problem solving strategy? Well, that's a bit that I like about it because it's complicated. So
right. And this is maybe a limited question and probably just wishful thinking, which is, if you had to prescribe one way to approach, or at least start approaching solving the majority of one's shoulder problems, where do you start? Is it addressing a movement pattern? Is it doing some kind of exercise, specific exercise? What is it? What's the Tim solution?
So if I was going to pick one thing, and I say this all the time, people should use the gymnastics rings more. And this is something that you can level with me on from your background. Mm-hmm. Maybe not doing like some of the advanced stuff that you would have done in the sport of gymnastics, But if we very simply, for a period of time, swapped bench pressing for ring push-ups, we'd be moving forwards. The if you think about what I said before with the brain being task-focused, the brain will select and execute a movement pattern based on the task and environment that we're asking it to move in. So if we go into rings where there is a level of instability, we have freedom to move the shoulder into different positions. We can go through greater ranges of motion. We can scale intensity really easily. And we have to connect the shoulder with the rest of the body because you are self-supporting your mass. So we're transferring and stabilizing forces through the spine, ribcage, pelvis as well. That's a very different thing for the shoulder compared to lying on a bench and doing a bench press where we are supported by gravity in the ground. What we're talking about here is if you go to the physiotherapy literature, what they're interested in from a rehabilitation perspective is range of motion, neuromuscular control, and kinetic chain integration. All I'm doing from a strength and conditioning perspective is taking the principles which are really well established and progressing and scaling them into an environment where people are not injured, but often compromised in their ability to be able to push their shoulder and upper body training forwards. So that's my one is, I don't want to go down the route of going, everyone needs to be doing banded external rotation work. Like, there's a role for it. It's a part of the solution, but it's a very isolated part. If we can start to think a little bit differently about exercise selection and take that principle, as you said before, of going, rather than thinking, well, 5x5 reps by 4 sets at this intensity in a squat is really good, so we'll just do that on the shoulder. I actually think, well, the shoulder's not designed like the lower body, so maybe it needs a different tool in order to get it to perform well.
Yeah, that's huge. There's so many layers here to peel back, but I kind of want to start with that framework you get that comes from physiotherapy, where you said range of motion. What was the second one?
Neuromuscular control.
Neuromuscular control, and then the third one was kinetic chain.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's just break down. What do those three mean? Range of motion just means that you should be able to cover a certain amount of movement in space. Neuromuscular control meaning that you have control over the full range of motion and that basically you're wired in a way where when you choose to move a certain way, whether it's consciously or unconsciously, that there is stability and control over that movement. And then what is kinetic chain when it comes to shoulder specifically?
Yes, it think about the kinetic chain as being the entire human movement system. The phrase I quite like about this is the shoulder is not an island. Like, it has to be connected to the other parts of the system. So let's take as a working example for people. If they look at the kinetic chain and force transfer through the shoulders, let's take a throwing or a striking sport. Roughly, depending on which research paper you look at, 50% of the force is going to be generated from the lower body, 30% from the midsection or your core, and then 20% from the shoulder. Now, if the kinetic chain isn't integrated and working efficiently, we might lose some of that force generation and force transfer potential. But we go into a sports-based context, and we still need to serve a tennis ball at 100 miles an hour, or throw a baseball, or throw a clean or a cluster, a thruster, whatever it might be. Now, if we're lacking the ability to generate and transfer forces, the shoulder then has to pick up the slack that's not being generated by the rest of the chain. So then it's going to pretty quickly reach its physiological capacity in a sense of, good, I could just like, I'll pick up, we need to execute. I got to punch this guy in the face at like full tilt, but I'm carrying a lot of the stuff. I've got this team on my back and I'm just trying to kind of get us through this thing. So if we can find ways where we can train the shoulder in a way which creates that connection, again, that those neurological pathways where we get better at transferring, stabilizing, and generating forces, total body, then the shoulder has an easier ride and we're not going to find that we're going to cause it so much of a potential overload.
My friends, I want to interrupt this podcast just for 30 seconds to say that if you made it this far, and up until this point, you haven't taken the time to either subscribe to the podcast or follow it on whatever platform you're listening on, to please do so. And if you have been enjoying this episode and previous episodes leading up to this one, to please go and rate and review. It helps a ton.
and it only allows me to do a better job at producing these episodes for you and potentially getting more guests that can, yeah, provide some amazing insight. So with that being said, thank you so much, and back to the episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is where the complexity comes into play, because there's very little we do in life where the shoulder is purely isolated. Even when we're sitting typing at our computer or whatever, moving around, the movement comes from the entire body. And to create a perfect, ideally, transfer of energy from your hips or from the ground force all the way down into the shoulder and then into your fingertips is massive. This is something that I think it was over 15 years ago, I went to the Titleist Performance Institute, where they were analyzing people's golf swing, and they were analyzing the speed of acceleration and deceleration of the lower body, upper body, arms, and then club, to make sure that the ball was hit correctly. And I think they were calling it like kinematic sequencing at the time. And it's a complex problem to solve, but it's a fundamental one. I'm curious, are you able, or do you compartmentalize your thinking when approaching solving shoulder problems? Or do you actually start with the kinematic sequence, the kinetic chain first, and then work your way into neuromuscular control and then range of motion? What's your approach if you took that three-prong lens right there
yeah, I love that.
To tackle this?
So one point you made before, every day is shoulder day. Right, we sometimes in our split bro routine, we would have like, oh, it's chest, or it's back, or it's, no, it's not. It's even buys and tries is shoulder, because we've got musculature which attaches to the scapula. Yeah. So we have to remember that we are loading it all the time, and that is a consideration about how much we think we can load a shoulder. In terms of the problem solving around this, I always start with, what are we asking the shoulder to do? Because that's super important. My example of that would have been, as I said before, with going back to play rugby, I've got really low level and low intensity neuromuscular control, and I can kind of do 4-point kneeling, and I'm able to lift my hand off the ground, and okay, cool, it physio signs you off. Nowhere near ready for the demands of the sport or the environment that I'm going to go back into. So that comes first. What are we trying to do? Let's reverse engineer the process from there. And then, and this is a fairly simple principle, I think, around solving human movement problems, but like, what, rather than asking like, what is injured, we go, why is it injured? So if we start a big picture and we go, let's look at the global movement pattern, let's look at everything, let's look at hip internal external rotation, because that might be causing a problem in a baseball athlete's ability to throw a fastball. And then we start to segment and problem solve in from there, of going, actually, you could jump in and go, external rotation is weak. Okay, but we've missed the fact that something else is causing a bigger problem. And until we fix that, we've got very minimal chance of having success with this very isolated strategy. So one of the movements that I'll test is a single leg squat. It gives me an idea around function. It shows me whether they've got pelvic, knee, and ankle stability. Because if I'm lacking there and we're in an athletic sport or context, that shoulder's not got a stable base to sit on. So I might need to do some hip work in order to create stability so that the shoulder has got a better structure to integrate with and can therefore be more efficient. So while people, I think, want to simplify things and go, oh, it's your serratus anterior, well, it might be, but that serratus is, and if you go down like fascial, like anatomy train lines, we are to talk about spiral lines. So now we start to think about how we integrate more of movement patterns into the muscle strength or isolated function that we need in order to make that a meaningful part of human movement and part of the brain's ability to execute movement patterns. Otherwise, we end up with a great serratus anterior, which is good in isolation, and like, people don't get better. They don't see improvements because it hasn't plugged it all back together and gone, boom, now we've got movement. Now we can bring it all together as one system.
Yeah. I can imagine. I was just, as you were speaking, I was just thinking about maybe my dad. Okay, he has a shoulder thing. He goes in to see you, and he comes in and he says, "Hey, Tim, I got this shoulder problem, impingement. Help me out." And you're like, "Okay, let's see your lunge or your single leg squat." He's like, why are you, why are you testing my squatting? That is ridiculous. But I think this right here is at the crux of the conversation. And I think it's so important because it's being able to think about movement as a gateway for solving specific problems. And right now, one of the things that I think you're tackling and you're doing such a beautiful job at is tackling solving this issue that traditionally has not been addressed from a holistic perspective and needs this integration to happen. So I just love hearing this from you. Question now. So we get an entry point. What is usually the process that you go through? So, for example, if people follow a program of yours, what's the structure of that program? How are you looking at it? What's the arc? If you could guide us through at least the experience and what people will be focusing on throughout.
Yeah, sure. So we've run now mostly a hybrid type approach. So we'll have some face-to-face testing diagnostics using some testing equipment so we can get some data on it. That's super important from both my perspective of removing some of the guesswork out of what often happens when you train the shoulder. So we can now very quickly isolate down to what potentially is the strength issue around the shoulder so that we can then be very specific about how we create a training program to tackle it. So that makes it sound like after all this kind of artistic talking, it's like, oh, I just test it and then does that. It's a layer, right? So the data and the diagnostics allows me more space on the training program to then be creative in how I pair and couple exercises together to get the outcome. So we'll then do that kind of assessment piece. And then often because we can now work remotely because of how technology provides that opportunity for us, they can go off into their own gyms, back to CrossFit. We never, very, very rarely ask people to stop doing what they are currently doing. I'll always try and integrate into that. And there might be a little bit of compromise at some point where it's like, I need one session just where I can have that time. But one of the big things that I value so massively these days, and it's more about, I've learned this over the last couple of years particularly, is the psychosocial approach. Don't pull somebody out of their community and tell them they can't engage in CrossFit and expect them to kind of just be perfectly happy doing your rehab program. If I can keep them plugged into their community, the social side of things, and we can continue to look after that wider holistic approach of the person and their journey back to high performance or whatever they want to do, we're just going to get massively more effective results. We just get better gains. There's probably a whole rabbit hole there, but in terms of the program, so once they then we've got the data, we've been creative around the training program. We've then basically got very simple sections and we will have, if it's required, some form of mobility. Sometimes that is because I want or need more range. We need to open up ranges of motion to move into. I'll still use quite a lot of self-myofascial release. And the reason for sharing that is some people, oh God, you've lost me foam rolling. It's sensory input. Tells the brain where the shoulder is before we're going to go and start training it. So there are so many different layers around that I think are of benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Then we'll have some control piece. So we'll do some stuff which is cuff or scapular related because it's useful, or hip related or ankle related. And then we'll have a potential priming type approach where we are looking at speed. So if someone's going to be Olympic weightlifting, if they're going to be throwing, tackling, contact sports, we need that shoulder to be able to stabilize quickly so that it can express force. If we are trying to express force on an unstable joint, we're either going to see a decrease in force output or we're going to see a potential for that shoulder to move around in the socket too much, which can then start to cause problems. And then we have strength training. So we'll have like whatever we're doing. If we're doing strength endurance, maximum strength, power-based work, we follow the same strength and condition principles. The bit in the middle there that links it all together is that I will, from that mobility control, either before or after the priming, there'll be a kinetic chain integration piece. Mm-hmm. So I'm then going to go and do something which brings that isolated work into a bigger pattern, which could be a ground-based movement or could be some crawling patterns, or we might hang, or we might do a lunge with a press or something like that. So I'm plugging it all back in, and then I'm going to go and train through that range with that control to then go and build the strength so that we've got that kind of that little cook it all together into a bit of a pot. But In my mind, that's a logical sequence. Create range, give it stability, integrate it into the chain, prime it so the brain is now working, and then we can go and get strong. Because strong is easy, right? It's not difficult to get strong if you can move well. So let's prioritize those things. And then we create constraints or challenges around the selection of exercises to get the shoulder to behave in a certain way to give me the output that I'm looking for. Does that sound like it makes sense?
Yeah, I mean,
that's the plan.
Perfect sense. Logically, that makes perfect sense. And the thing that stuck with me from the very beginning is this psychosocial aspect that you address, which is don't pull people out of the thing that they love or out of their lives to fix the problem. Help them navigate the world that they love with a new approach, and then leverage that new awareness to pursue all the different aspects that go through this arc of progression, so to speak, for developing a strong, healthy, dynamic shoulder capacity. Now, to shift gears a little bit here, and just thinking now broadly, what is something that, for example, you do on a daily basis that allows you to either maintain or remain on an incremental progression for having a dynamic shoulder in your language?
Listen to what my shoulder's telling me. This is the biggest lesson that people can learn about training. So it's not an exercise. There are lots of different methods. Like I love that quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson about always principles over methods. You understand principles, you can make your own methods. But so you, whether it's whichever progression of movement you want to choose from a training perspective is fine, and most of them work to a certain point. The bit that I think people struggle with the most, and what I'm getting better at, and interestingly even better at as I get older, is waking up in the morning, going warming up, and being like, I don't feel great today. Like I haven't slept well. I've got two kids. They've not slept. Like, why am I going to come in and push myself something that I feel like I ought to do, when the actual massive benefit is to maybe modify that session a bit, not do something, so that tomorrow and the next 3 weeks and whatever, I can continue to do it. One of the examples, let's make it shoulder specific, right, is rotator cuff fatigue is one of the primary contributors to a shoulder injury. So if you go in and you've got all of your stress bucket and the rest of your life is overflowing because work, family, whatever, is kind of all kicking off, you've been training for the last however many days straight, you've coming off a high intensity workout, but you're in a group based session or whatever it is, and your shoulder doesn't feel great, you're at risk of that shoulder then having an issue. If we then go like hard into it, fatigue is high, and then the rotator cuff or the shoulder has a bit of a problem, you might be 12 weeks back from that before you can then get back to that same level. So you just lost 3 months for one session when you could have just gone, I'm not going to do that today, and then come back in, have a little bit of a reset, have some more sleep, get like look after your recovery, deload a little bit, whatever. If people knew how much resource was given to elite sport in terms of athlete health and keeping elite athletes healthy, so that they can stitch together consistent, long-term, high-quality blocks of training. These days, it is massive.
Mm-hmm.
Injured athletes can't win medals, so we have to keep them training, because we know over a four-year Olympic or Paralympic cycle, those that can train more consistently for 4 years have got a pretty good chance of being in a decent place to be able to go and win a medal, right? So, but in
exactly,
like CrossFit's a great example of this. It's like, oh, I do 6 days a week. Okay, like, but I get people all the time like, right, I've got CrossFit tonight, my shoulder feels really banged up. Which exercise should I modify? And I'm like, maybe just don't go to CrossFit, or like do something different, and that would be okay for a day, to give your chance, that the shoulder the chance to bounce back a little bit, which it will. But let's just not keep banging it up. But people don't want to hear that; they just want to train. And I don't think it's
right.
It's that level of awareness of self and where I'm at for my recovery adaptation, and being able to make informed decisions around it and not getting stressed about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think that awareness piece is huge. And this is very habit-based. I think people find a way where they express themselves physically. They develop an identity around this, whether it's CrossFit or any other sport, running. And then they continue to do the same thing. And that in the beginning maybe serves as a way of progressing and then eventually becomes something that scratches an itch or brings people back to baseline in terms of how they feel psychologically and emotionally. But physically, they start to run into walls and then they struggle to shift their approach. And I think one of the things that you're doing really well is helping people shift their approach to how they think about their physical performance. I mean, I was listening to somebody, I can't even remember where this was, but maybe it was on like Tim Ferriss's podcast or something, but somebody was on there. He was maybe in his mid-50s. And he said, I never bench, like benching is bad type thing. And I thought, interesting theory on physical expression, because I don't think there are any black and whites. It's all gray, and it's learning to navigate. My question now is, how are people receiving the information that you're sharing, whether if you're going to a conference or if you're talking to physiotherapists or doctors or orthopedic surgeons? What are people saying about what you're talking about? Is it being well received? Are you having some challenges? How is that experience at the moment?
Yes, I'm smiling because I know it's coming at some point. So far it has all been received really well, and a little bit of a if I want to call it imposter syndrome that I had to begin with was coming and talking about shoulders from a strength and conditioning perspective to and with physiotherapists, because it's like, that's not really the strength and conditioning coach's lane to be having conversations around how we look after a shoulder. That's physiotherapists do that piece. I looked at it and went, you know what? Why shouldn't we as coaches have the confidence, if we actually had the skills, to be able to work with somebody who's not so banged up or injured that they need to go to physio, but coming into the gym day after day, week after week, but with a shoulder which is compromised, like they're not going to the physio. So we need to serve them because it's not that bad, but they're still not being able to do the thing they want to be able to do. So it's been really good because there's a lot of physiotherapists that I respect. They've seen our work through School of Calisthenics and we gained credibility with that because of how we delivered it, who have now gone like, this is like, you've really brought a piece of the puzzle to the table that is lacking. And I think physios recognize that in some cases, and not all, but across the board, let's generalize, their ability to load and do the bit the strength and conditioning coaches do really well isn't as good as it could be. And let's also be honest that strength and conditioning coaches and personal trainers' understanding of injury rehabilitation isn't as good as it probably should be. So because we are now sitting effectively in the middle of that space, with a good understanding of both, and I'm still learning all the time, but what we're saying is not wrong. It's proven through the literature, and all I'm doing is going, look, these principles that we all agree with, I'm doing the same thing over here. It just looks a little bit different to what it's looked like before. So it's largely been very welcomed, but I'm laughing because, you know, like whenever you start gaining any level of audience, somebody at some point is going to stick their head above the parapet and start having a pop at you. And like, I've been in this game long enough that I don't care, even if it does come. But if it doesn't, I believe you kind of like, if we are genuinely going out there and putting positive messaging out and we are genuinely coming with a heart to serve people, to help them to improve, then like, you can argue about whether I use the right exercise or not, but the principle of what we're doing is sound. It's based on evidence and science and tried and tested practices, which has now been further established through how many clients we've worked with over the last 2 years.
Yeah, amazing. Tell me a little bit, how do you currently coach? Do you do one-on-ones? Do you do group? Do you do just online? Do you have an online program that's what you focus on putting out there? Do you go to conferences? Is it podcasting like this? How do you currently spend most of your time supporting people in that you're educating people on and coaching them through?
So it's largely now, like, as I said, the hybrid approach of we'll do a lot of our assessments in person. So someone will come in for an hour, spend some time with us. We get all the data collection that we need and whatnot there. Do that face-to-face relationship building, which is super important. And then the rest of my week is spent working with people online. So we write the training programs and then there's a backwards and forth of a conversation and feedback and evolution of the training program. So in our personal coaching environment, we are effectively writing 1 week at a time. How's that week gone? Right, let's evolve the program if we need to. And this is such a massive point. I'm sharing this because I think how this kind of work is done from a rehabilitation perspective is traditionally delivered is a bit broken. He goes to somebody and go, here's three exercises, come back and see me in 3 weeks, versus go to somebody and go, here's 1 week of an actual training program that's fun to do, and I'm going to check in with you throughout the week to see how it's going. And if you have a problem, you can come back to me and I can correct it for you, or we can change the program. Like accountability, like adaptability, like we just massively double down on the potential for getting a good outcome for people. So that's what our thing is built around. It's built around serving each individual person, providing what they need, evolving, putting the support in place. We go to a lot of effort to extend so that people feel heard, seen, valued, understood, and we shape our service and provision around that.
That's perfect. Yeah, I think that kind of almost like concierge type service and really focusing on the individual to guide them all the way through to achieving that which you know is possible, and then two, allowing them to express themselves the way that they want at the highest level, requires that level of attention. I'm curious, at this moment in time within your business, I know you and Karen run the business together. Do you work mostly from home, or do you go to a gym? How does it work for you there?
So Karen and I recently just, we got an office space, which has been an absolute game changer for us because we were working at home. That was the hangover of 2020 and all that kind of stuff. So we recently moved our workspace into a separate building because we've got two kids, so we were like, it was all becoming a very gray melee of home and life and work, and there was no separation. So oftentimes now I'm getting out and about quite a bit. So I was in London yesterday, I was in Glasgow last week. I was like, so we'll do these day trips out to go and see people, and then a lot of the rest of the time is then going to be in the office. So that honestly, like coming home on a Friday, having been at the office and then coming into the house where we then do family for the weekend, has been like night and day in terms of our ability to be able to maximize our performance in both of those arenas.
Yeah, that's huge. Because right now you're sitting, I believe you're in your home gym, right?
Yeah.
And this is this where you were running most of your business from through the pandemic?
Yeah, it was. So we've actually now, I've got half of my gym more now because my desk was over that side and where my squat rack and stuff is. So even when I was in here before, at the home office, I was looking at my workspace while I was training, and it was just awful because of letters there and whatever, computers on the desk, and just not productive on either side, I don't think. So we will sometimes use this space to film content for clients. If I get a client that comes through that I don't have an exercise filmed for, then we've got a space which we can readily create it. And then we'll also then go and film out in other people's gyms where we can go and kind of bulk record content for the program delivery side of things. But we were at home and this was our space, and it was all mangled together.
Yeah. That's a challenging one. It's kind of like, going to bed in a messy room and just looking around and feeling like, everything feels undone, and having a hard time focusing on the thing that you should be focusing on. So having that separation is definitely needed. I'm curious, Tim, in your evolution from school of calisthenics to now shoulder focus, what was that transition like? Was that due to the pandemic, or was that a deliberate decision that was premeditated? How did that happen?
Yeah, it's a combination of things, to be honest. So I'd had this thing around shoulders that I wanted to do at some point, because personally, I've got a personal connection with it as well. So I wanted to help people so they didn't have to do the 15 years of exploration that I'd done to get to a place where my shoulder was feeling good. And also, yeah, I mean, 2020 was a difficult time for a lot of businesses, but we came to a stage where, like, there was everyone locked in the house doing bodyweight training. We have a business in bodyweight training in the School of Calisthenics, and then the pandemic finished, and we were like, hey, do you want to do bodyweight training? And people were like, nah, I'll go back to the gym.
So, right, and we're like, we're done.
Let's just kind of leave it. And it's not that it's not, it's still there. We still have it. It's still kind of, it still exists. But I think there was a time where, for both Jack and I, and people have seen mine and Jacko's journeys going to start in different directions independently, whereas we still have School of Calisthenics. But I think we were both had other things and other interests that we wanted to explore and itches to scratch in some ways. And like, I'm a person who likes to continue to learn and move forwards. And there's a certain amount of, like, with calisthenics, we'd understood what our level was. We were never going to be like the really high-end calisthenics athletes. We came to it too late. We brought too much injury baggage to the table. And to be honest, we probably weren't good enough to be able to be doing like some of the super cool stuff that you get 18 and 19-year-olds doing and just putting us to shame. So we knew our space was in that really beginners and getting people going into the fundamentals of calisthenics. And once we kind of done that hands-down coaching piece for a long time, you're sort of going, well, I think I just needed something a little bit different of going, you know, you're coaching closed skills. There is an efficient way. We'd worked out what our efficient way to coach a closed skill was. And it was then repeating the same thing. So I was super grateful for like that process. I love understanding skill acquisition, but I needed more complexity for me. My brain, my background in Olympic, you know, in elite strength and conditioning was Paralympic sport. Like, I loved the whole thing of going, how do you train a guy who's missing two legs to run 200 meters? Like, that stuff for me is brilliant. And I think that's where the urge or desire to want to go and find another complex problem to get my teeth stuck into really came from.
Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense. And it's cool to see how you and Jacko have evolved over the last couple of years, and how these parallel paths that you have, you can see that the foundation comes from all the work that you did through the School of Calisthenics. And it's cool to see that it all lives on and it's all evolving. I think that's pretty special. I'm curious, now a family life, how old are your kids?
Jack's 6 and Naomi is 2.5. I say 2.5 because of that.
Brutal.
It's like, yeah, it's like 2.5 is very different to 2, which is very different to 3 at that age. So, but Jack is a solid 6. He's just 6 and he's amazing.
Yeah. So I remember when your youngest was about to be born, you started doing some sleep training where you were starting to go to bed earlier so you could wake up earlier and get work done. And I just remember you sharing that online. I was thinking, oh yeah, he knows what's coming and he wants to be productive. I'm curious because just my experience over the last 3 years has been this rapid evolution of all of a sudden having sleepless nights to then being able to sleep, but then having other more complex problems to solve during the day, especially with a boy that is very active in our household and you're constantly chasing. You can't look away for more than 20 seconds before he gets into something. I'm just wondering, how do you do it? How do you have 2 kids, try to run a business, keep your marriage, work with your spouse? How do you tackle this dynamic problem of a family, business, and everything else?
Yeah, that a few people say that, so they're like, gosh, how do you do it? And honestly, like, we just do. It kind of works. Like, Cara and I have a very, everyone's got a special relationship, but ours is for what we do together. Like, there's a lot of people say, I could never work with my partner. How do you, I would just get so frustrated with them. But we wanted to work together properly for many years. And she'd had a business which I'd worked for her, and she'd done some stuff for me with School of Calisthenics. And we never had this like equal kind of 50-50 where it was like, it was our thing. And there was a little bit around us of going, this is where you can speak real wisdom into, but we started with the lifestyle design. Like, what do we want life to be like? And we love being all in together. We are, Cara and I, like chips on the table. Like, that ride or die kind of like relationship. We're either going to do it together, or we'll be sat under a bridge together. Like, it will be, there'll be no division within that. So we built the business and how we work. We challenge ourselves on this on a regular basis of how do we do this so that we can build a high performing business, whatever that looks like. We're still kind of building it, and I can put my kids to bed every night. And I can take him to school in the morning if I want to. And that means I work early and I work late. But I get a lot of time with my kids. And we're really invested in knowing that what we do at this age with where they are now is going to create and set up the family life dynamic and relationships that I want with my kids when they are 18 years old. So I can't not be here for 7-8 years. And all of a sudden expect to be super close to my kids when they're 18. Like, so we're like the delayed gratification at the moment. And we probably sacrificed a little bit of business performance. We definitely sacrifice on personal things that we do for ourselves. But knowing that we are like planting all the time for future outcomes that we are hoping for. If our kids turn out to like us in 10 years time or whatever, want to spend time with us.
Right. You never know. You never know. Yeah. I think that's such a big deal to be able to cooperate and collaborate in that way. So what does your day look like? Do you have to wake up at 4 to be able to get stuff done before taking the kids to school? Or have you managed to figure out how to pack it all in while they're at school?
A bit of both. So I work pretty much full-time 5, 6, 7 days a week on the business. Corin has a day a week with Naomi, our youngest. Corin's from South Africa, speaks Afrikaans, so she speaks Afrikaans to the kids at home. So having that time with Naomi now, where like Naomi's really cute, she has a mixture of English and Afrikaans, and she's like, oh, wow. Now she's learning to talk a little bit, which is quite cool. But so Corin carries a lot of that side of stuff and works. So she's like a superhuman in that sense. So she makes sure the house runs and the kids have got what they need. I'm not very good at that sort of stuff. And then she rocks up to work and basically does the managing director operational side of what we do whilst I'm then out doing shoulders. So my day at the moment, and this is a pattern that I've just recently started to get more comfortable with, is I couldn't get my training in. So I was, once the day had started, I found it very difficult to break the day, go and train, go back to work, or get to the end of the day and have any gas left in the tank to actually do anything. So my day starts at around 5:20. I come downstairs, I'm in my house gym, so I get my workout done for the day, so it happens. And that's protected time, right? The kids aren't awake, so nothing can interfere with that. That's, I can control that hour in the morning of 5:30 to 6:30. Sometimes the intensity is good. Sometimes if Naima's not slept very well, then it won't be, but I don't beat myself up about it. We do breakfast together typically on a normal day, and then the kids will do drop-off, and often even Cara and I will sometimes drive the kids to the drop-off, which is like 5-10 minutes away. We do that together. We come back together. We go to the office together. So like, we are very much kind of adjoined and connected when we can be, but then Cara and we divide and conquer on the other things. And then yeah, we work hard during the day, come back, kids have dinner together, put the kids to bed, do stories, all that kind of stuff. And then we'll often do another hour or two in the evening to make it work, because we know that we need that time, especially with a fledgling business. So we have to sometimes go to bed at 9, 10 o'clock, but then we have a hard stop. So there is no working past 10, preferably 9, otherwise we don't sleep. So then that sabotages us for the next day. So we've found out what roughly works for us, and we just flex it as we need to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's wonderful. How has having kids changed your outlook on life?
I'm so much more aware and cognizant of like mento mori, like I'm gonna die. And this sounds quite morbid, but it's about like the value in the time of. I'm 42 now, so we waited quite a long time. We were married 15 years now, so we waited like 8 years until we had 8-9 years until we had Jack. And So I now look at it and go, I don't know how many more years I've got left. And then also, like, I hear these stories like all the time now of like 55-year-olds just like keeling over and like game over. And we're all sat here go, well, I'm going to get to 80, at least 80. Well, that's not guaranteed. So my perspective now of like having Jack and Naomi is the time that I spend with them, however long that is and whatever the future holds, like we try and be massively invested and present with them. And I'm not great at it sometimes. I'm often distracted by work on my phone and social media and all the things that pull our attention. But we are trying to find that balance of living for the now, but also knowing that we might live until 80. And what do we need to do to make sure that that's going to be fun and enjoyable? But it's been, and you'll know this, like it is, it's the hardest and the best thing ever. Like, I wouldn't change it for the world. The relationship I have with the kids is the most, like, fulfilling and rewarding thing I have in my life. But to get it is massively challenging. Like, it's hard.
Yeah. It's rough. And do you ever find yourself beating yourself up when you realize that you're losing attention, or maybe you lose your temper maybe in a moment of stress, or are you able to manage that pretty well and compartmentalize and maybe exercise some stoicism, or how do you work through that, and does that influence in any way the way that you run your business, as it's such an integrated piece of everything that you do?
Yeah, Cara and I are quite different on this one. Cara's got, and she won't mind me saying this, and she'll listen back to it, but she will say herself that I am the patient one in our relationship. That's probably fair. And that it takes a lot for me to get to that point. But of course, like, there are times when I blow up or I'm under pressure or trying to rush to get out of the house because I've got stuff to do, and you're short with the kids and, but I think communication is a big part of what makes our family and business dynamic work. Like, Cara and I talk about everything. There's often times we come and spend time with other people, and they're like in relationships and husband and wife, and they go, we've not really like talked about this thing. And I'm like, that's a big thing. Like, how have you not discussed that? So we talk a lot. And then we also, being a coach, I can't help but coach my kids. So if something happens, we often then I'll sit down with Jack and I'll have a conversation with him about why did it happen and what could we do differently and da 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 da. So I think Jack understands a lot about what we do. He's a very smart kid and he sees us work. And I'll say to him, Jack, I need to go downstairs and work. So I need you to go to bed because I've got a call in 10 minutes and I need to be downstairs to take this call. It started off as I used to say to him, Jack, Daddy needs to work. And I said to him, and we went through this process, I'm going to explain to him, I was like, Daddy needs to work so Daddy can earn some money. And I said to him, what do you want to do? What happens when Daddy earns money? And he goes, we go on nice holidays. And I was like, yes, that's how it works. So however you need to attach this to what we need to get done, like we'll make that work. But yeah, it's a work in progress, but I think communication pulls that together and allows us to kind of do the things that we need to be able to do. And we aren't perfect. I'm painting a picture, sounds like we're the like perfect family picture. It's not, but we're trying to do something that we know is not easy. And I said to Karen a while ago, I was like, are we crazy? Because crazy people don't know they're crazy. They just keep doing what they're doing, thinking that it's everybody else that's a bit weird. I was like, really starting a business, doing this thing with the kids, like, is this just, but we don't want to change it. Like, it's going well. So we're like, well, let's keep going because it's working. We have the kids relationship. We have the business, which is growing, and our marriage is great. And we're like, well, what else do we need? Like, if it's going, let's just keep pulling on that thread and just see where it leads us.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, our household can be a madhouse. And sometimes I'm like, what are we doing? Are we absolutely insane? And we lose our minds quite often, and sometimes, you know, kids get wedged between the parents, and it can be pretty complicated. But I think it's a leveler, and it does add a tremendous amount of perspective. And for me especially, seeing the speed at which the kids evolve is insane, because it really also puts it on you and says, hey, the clock is ticking. I'm 41, going to be 42. I've only had 41 summers. That's not a lot of summers.
Yeah.
I've only had 41 winters. That's not a lot of winters. And like you were saying, if the age expectancy or the life expectancy is 80, that means I only have 40 more. What am I going to do with these 40? And it's a big one. It really does allow you to maximize your investment.
Yeah.
I like that. Talk to me a little bit about physical culture at home. You said you coach your kids. What does physical culture within the household look like? Are you like, hey, it's a Saturday at 6 a.m. Everybody up. We're gonna knock out. We're going for a run. What's happening?
So people who follow me on social media might have seen this, but the physical culture and it's not intentional. It's just how Cara and I live. Is we probably, to our kids, lead by example. We train, we're active people, we move. Like, Corinne's got her thing, she plays hockey at quite a high level. Like, we have a gym in the house, and Jack just thinks that this is a playground. So we just got a Concept 2 bike erg. He comes down now, and I explained to him the other week what an EMOM was. So he wrote one on the board today, and he's actually written one up today. I'm looking at it now. It says Naomi's workout. So he comes in his pajamas. I'm training in the morning typically, and he comes down and he goes, he's got his pajamas on, he goes and put his trainers on, he comes in, he goes, right, what are we doing today? And he just wants to move, because he sees that we do that and it must be an important thing. So he might jump on the bike and he'll just go and churn out a 1K time trial. And he's pissed off every morning if he doesn't
want
PB. Like, but he can't even sit on the seat. He has to stand.
Oh boy.
And just like, so he's like, I don't ever want to say to him, don't move, don't exercise, you don't need to do this. So when he comes in and he says, he's written up today, push-ups, rows, and burpees. Not burpees, bird, B-I-R-D-P-E-A-S. That's what he's written on the board. And if I said to him, it's a 12, I said, how long do you want to do? He'd go, I'll do 12 minutes. So he's coming in now, he's setting his exercises and he's setting how he moves. But when they go to school and they get 2 hours of PE in a whole week, and for the rest of the time they're sat in lessons, I will never tell him not to move. It's frightening how little activity I think they do in a school week. But he wants to play all the sports, and he wants to. Please, can't wait to go to rugby. He's playing tennis, so I'm trying to not use it like a science project, but it's a science project. It's about what happens if a strength and conditioning coach has a child who's into movement from a young age. What can you create? It's a little bit of going like, what do you know? And at the moment, I just want to make him love movement and I want to make him athletic so that he can choose then what he wants to do when he gets to a stage. And I don't really care how good he gets at it, but he just needs to love it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's huge. I think modeling is the best way of coaching most of the times, and especially with kids. You just do your thing and you realize that they're imitating you all the time. I mean, just the other day, I was trying to get this guy to bed, and he wasn't going to bed, and just running out of the room. And then all of a sudden, I just stayed in the room. I was waiting there for him to come back, and I heard him in the living room counting, and he was going, 1, 2. And I was like, what is he doing? I look out, and he's on the furniture doing pull-ups. 1, 2. I was like, dude, you're killing me, but that's good stuff. So get your pull-ups in before
Well, how smart
bed.
Are they? He's like, yeah, you're not going to stop me from doing pull-ups because I know that you think pull-ups are important. So I'll go and do something which is you're not going to tell me I can't do. And it's like, oh, you're smart. Like, you're manipulating me.
Yeah, I mean, they're genius. And it's funny, we're doing potty training, and he thinks training and potty training is the same thing. So he will grab a dumbbell and be like, potty training. I'm like, that's a different type of training. But yes, you're right. That is so cool that's the case. And that, he can write his own workouts and come down and see you there in the morning. That must be like a very special bonding moment and feel pretty special. Last question. If there was one message that you wanted your kids to know about physical culture, training, and being healthy, what's the message you want them to carry?
That's a good question. Depends on whether you go from a more of a kind of scientific. The underpinning of it is, right, they just need to know that how, like, the human body is designed to move, right? Good things happen when we move. And it doesn't matter how you move, you just need to move. And we've had some, like, Karen's mum had quite a traumatic incident with a spinal operation that went wrong. So it ended up making her paralyzed from the rib cage from about T6 down, basically. So Jack's going to see this as he grows up, and a lot of that could have been sort of resolved or at least helped, because it was a number of things which led up to that, with an approach to movement and strength training and physical activity that would have been beneficial. And I think people could see that in all of their parents from a generation ago. Actually, if you hadn't got sucked into that midlife like lethargy almost around your own well-being, your physical health, then you'd be in a much more able state when you are 60, 70, or 80. I still want to take Jack snowboarding when I'm like old, and like, I don't want to kick it like and just be the guy who stays at home while my kids are off enjoying themselves. So I just want him to know that like movement is essential. Everything, the brain works better when you move. Like your life is better when you move. You're healthier, you're going to get less sickness. Like if you can build your lifestyle around movement, then everything else that you want is going to be optimized. I can't think of one thing where you go, oh, it's better if you don't have movement as part of that. Like work performance, opportunities to do exciting things, to have experiences that you remember. Like your friends go, let's go snowboarding. Sweet, I'm an athlete. I can go snowboarding and I'll be okay at it. Like, and you have this wicked time away in the mountains with your friends. And I just want him to be like, to have that opportunity to take that one thing that I can give him. If I can't give him some things, it's just not going to be what my skill set is, but I can teach him to have a love for movement. Mm-hmm. And if I can pass that on to him and optimize his life because of that, then that will be a massive win for me. And you play to your strengths, right? That's what I can give him. I know movement, so I can teach him to move.
Yeah, that's huge. And something you said earlier, which I think is great, is that your kids see, you know, your house and the gym as a playground. And I think seeing the world as a playground is huge. Mm-hmm. And finding a way of, keeping that alive for the rest of their existence is probably the way that you'll be the most successful.
And as to your point, some of the stuff that you're into as well, of going like, can I expose you to action sports? So I have this thing with the kids where I want them to learn freestyle sports at the right age. Because there's less rules there. Like we put them straight into football or cricket or whatever, or rugby, and we go, here's the rules you've got to play by. So Jack's first exposure to sports was BMX racing, because we've got a club which is close to the house. So he's actually really decent on his bike. And I'm going to go have that piece of that culture. And then we took him to kickboxing. I go, right, now have this element of like focus and discipline and coordination. Now he's doing a bit of tennis. And I just think that opportunity to just open the horizons up and go, this is what it looks like, and now you can choose whatever you like. But I love action sports. I think it's the coolest sport, because mm-hmm. there are no rules, but it comes with like inherent risks and whatever else. So you've got to be prepared to see that, the downside of that in your kids. But I think the mindset of going, I'm a non-conformist in these sports, and that is now I'm going to take that skill into whatever profession I choose. I'm going to go and disrupt stuff, because that's who I am, a core part of like what my early years experiences were.
Yeah. You know, and this goes back to what you were saying earlier about the psychosocial component of performance, which is you want to keep people in a place where they're psychologically, socially, emotionally feeling connected and well, because that's where they're going to continue to express themselves. And I think if we can continue to find ways of either tweaking our environment or putting ourselves in an environment that allows that expression, or allows us to navigate an environment that maybe by injury or an improper approach to navigating that environment, that just by making small changes, you can continue to do that and and it can be something playful. I think that's the way that we keep ourselves and the future generation potentially in a steady progression of health and well-being.
Play is a sense of it, right? If you were to boil my philosophy down and where we would end up with calisthenics, it is around play. And we've lost a lot of that in our adult lifestyles and culture and social norms of where we don't do that much anymore because it's almost frowned upon. But one place where you do see play is in action-based sports because it's all play, it's all exploration. And I think fostering that as part of a movement and what that does from a mindset of how you then go out and solve problems in the world and contributes to the furtherment of humanity's evolution, then I think that's like those, we need people that don't think the same as everyone else. So let's put them into environments where people don't think the same and let's break the rules, because I've become far more skeptical as I'm getting older that we are all being mass manipulated and we just don't know it as much as we think. So go and break things down a bit and cause some problems for people, because I think that's the way we need to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've become more skeptical and maybe a little bit more cynical over the years, especially after the pandemic. It's hard to trust what's coming out of bigger organizations or government. And I think it's time to take that into our own hands. But I'm glad there's conversations like this. There are people like you out there that are trying to make it happen in a way that's leading to self-direction and self-governance. So I think that's really cool. Tim, I'm going to let everybody know how to find you and how to connect with you in the show notes and description. But is there any final message or anything that you would like for people to be aware of, especially if they are suffering from some kind of shoulder injury or shoulders have been a problem within their athletic or life career and journey?
Yeah, 100%. So I think that the overriding message is like there is a way forwards to out of where you're currently at. If you only stay in that space you are now, it's that cliche quote, if you only ever do what you've currently done, I can't even get it out now. You know the quote, I mean, you're most basic.
Yeah.
If you don't change
it, the same
you're
going
to expect the same results. Yeah,
exactly.
So don't do that. Like, because I think sometimes if you're in your 20s, you can think you're bomb-proof, but there'll come a point in your life where you're not in your 20s and having a shoulder, whatever body part, which is just a weak link, which is going to affect your quality of life and the things that you want to be able to do. So I just think don't live with it thinking you can't do anything about it. You just need to find the right solution. And I came from a place of having a really, really unstable shoulder. Like, it was bad. So if I can get to a place where I can do handstands and human flags, I'm N equals one. We're now manufacturing that and helping other people to do the same kind of things. Not, it doesn't have to be a handstand or human flag. It can be whatever you want it to be, but know that that is a high level expression of what the shoulder can do. And that was the whole point. So just take action, do something, find the right people. If that's us, then come and talk to us about it for sure. We're now kind of working across a very much an interdisciplinary approach. And we can put the right people in your path to be able to support you and actually do this as a collaborative approach so that it's not siloed anymore. It's how do we build this person, this shoulder, with what skill sets we need to do that to get you the outcomes that you're looking for.
Amazing. Tim, thank you so much for sharing. I appreciate everything that you're doing. I'm a fan, and I hope everybody listening felt encouraged and inspired and if need be, ready to connect with you, as I think there's a lot of value that you can be providing for them. So, thank you, Tim. And I look forward to part two of this in the future.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to spend some time with you. I appreciate it.
Of course. Yeah, my pleasure.
This is the Freestyle Way.